for me to reach, and after telling us that the doctor would be in shortly, she left, and my mother helped me situate myself on the bed so that I could look and feel normal as possible, normal enough for my father to get back to business.
So walk me through this, son. You got to the store.
I got to the store just to get gum and chips. I picked the bag of chips I wanted, and then I bent down and dug in my bag to try to get my phone so I could call Spoonie. This lady didn't see me squatting behind her and tripped over me. Then I lost my balance and the bag of chips went flying. The cop assumed I had done something to the lady, which I didn't. The dude who works the register looks up and thinks I'm trying to put the chips in my bag, but I wasn't. Then the cop rushed me and yoked me up all crazy. I paused, then added, and that's it. My mother sat quietly, and my father paced back and forth from the door to the window. Ma was clearly horrified. But Dad, he had on that, son, you aren't telling me everything look. It was clear that to him, I had to have done something wrong to bring this on.
Were your pants sagging?
Dad interrogated, now back over by the door.
Were my pants sagging? I repeated, shocked by the question. What does that have to do with anything?
Oh, it matters. If it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck.
My mother glared at him.
David! This is your son we're talking about. The boy's never even been suspended.
But they don't know that, Dad said. What they see is what he presents, and it sounds like he presented himself as just another what?
Ma cut in again, this time her voice spiking to that don't start level. Dad swallowed the rest of his statement.
Well, they said you resisted arrest, he continued in another direction. If you didn't do anything wrong, why would you resist arrest?
His voice began to rise.
And how many times have I told you and Spoonie, I mean, since y'all were young, we've been going over this. Never fight back. Never talk back. Keep your hands up. Keep your mouth shut. Just do what they ask you to do and you'll be fine.
That was another one of those way too familiar songs Spoonie and I were forced to sing when we were kids. Every time Dad said it, it was always the same. Just like the army talk. But this one was even worse because it had a rhythm to it, like a poem or a chant.
Never fight back. Never talk back. Keep your hands up. Keep your mouth shut. Just do what they ask you to do and you'll be fine.
I know, and I did all that, I said, running through the scenario in my head again.
I didn't fight back. I couldn't. And I didn't say jack besides trying to explain that I hadn't done nothing wrong. But before I could even get a word out, he was all over me.
You couldn't have, Dad said, matter of fact.
He looked at me as if he didn't know me and shook his head, as if he was disappointed. As if I asked for this. That really pissed me off. That really, really got me going because I was being blamed for something I didn't do, not just by that stupid store clerk and that asshole cop, but also by my father. A burning sensation rose in my chest and stomach, the fractured ribs sizzling. My eyes began to water with frustration.
I did!
My voice shattered in my throat and came out pitchy and emotional.
You don't gotta believe me, but I did.
I turned my head away. You know who did believe me? My brother Spoonie. He showed up a few minutes later after working an overnight shift at UPS and catching a quick nap. And let me tell you, when he arrived, he was full of fire. First was the obligatory mother hug. Spoonie ran over to our mom and gave her a hug and a kiss on the cheek, made sure she was all right. Then came the, Dad. That's all Spoonie said to him. Just an acknowledgement of his presence. It's not that he was beefing with our father or that they didn't get along. I take that back. They really didn't get along. They just couldn't see eye to eye on most things. Dad was all about discipline and believed that if you work hard, good things happen to you no matter what. Of course, part of working hard to him was looking the part, dressing the part, and speaking the part, which Spoonie didn't really vibe with. Spoonie had, maybe 8 or 9 locks sprouting from his head like antennae, thick and matted like strips of carpet, but I always thought they looked pretty cool. Dad, not so much.
They'll think you're doing drugs, he'd say.
Spoonie's clothes were always too,
or three, or four sizes too big. That was just his style. That was pretty much his whole generation's style. 90s hip-hop, gritty realness. Wu-Tang, Biggie, hoodies, and unlaced boots. "They'll think you're selling drugs," Dad would say. "Why can't you get a haircut? Why can't you dress like a respectable adult? Why can't you set an example for your brother, huh, son? Why?" And because Spoonie was tired of explaining himself, and Dad was tired of asking him to change, they kept their conversation short and sweet. Like Spoonie greeting him, "Dad?" Head nod. Followed by Dad saying, "Spoonie?" Head nod. And that was that. Spoonie came over to my bed. "Lil' bruh, you good?" he said, something grape flavored on his breath. "I'm good." "What happened?" I started running the story down and got about halfway through, just up to when the cop pressed me, when Spoonie lost it. "See," he said, looking around to our parents. "See, this is that bullshit. I'm so sick of them treating us like we animals, like we America's disobedient dogs." "Calm down, Spoonie," Ma said, which only made it worse. "Calm down? Calm down?" Spoonie's voice got significantly less calm. "Haven't we been a little too calm? They get to do whatever they want to us, to him, to your son, and we're supposed to just calm down?" He put his hands on his head, flattening his locks, rocking back and forth in that way people do right before they punch a wall. "Spoonie, and he was unarmed." "Calm down. Do you know the stats? It's something like black people are twice as likely to have no weapons on them when they're killed by cops. Twice as likely. Should I run down the list of people this has happened to? Calm down? Let's paint their names on the walls and watch. There'll be enough to give the entire hospital a fresh new look. Then tell me to calm down. He could have been killed." "But he wasn't," Dad said, deadpan. He seemed totally unimpressed by Spoonie's outburst and probably wrote it off as theatrics. He was always calling Spoonie a rebel without a cause. "But he could have been. For a bag of chips that he was gonna pay for. For having brown skin and wearing his jeans a certain way. And guess what, Dad? That ROTC uniform was right there in that bag. The bag was open, so that cop probably saw it. But did it matter?" Spoonie's voice fanned, the anger breaking him down. "That's enough," Ma said firmly. Dad and Spoonie glared at each other until finally Dad turned away and looked out the window. Ma just sat on the bed, rubbing my hand, her eyes wet from it all. Spoonie leaned against the wall, and I sat there thinking about what was going to happen to me. I know my father and brother were arguing about what had happened, but all I could think about in that moment was what was going to happen next. Would the charges stick? Would they follow me around, a smudge on my record until I was 18 when it would finally disappear? Does anything actually disappear these days? The silence was much worse than the yelling. So I fiddled with the remote. The same one that controlled my bed controlled the television. I turned it on. Too bad TV sucks on Saturday morning unless you're a little kid or a politician. And politics are painful to watch. Boring. So the sound of helium-pitched cartoon characters had to be the life raft for this sinking ship of awkwardness. Thankfully, the doctor came in to save us from the equally awkward distraction of cartoons. "Good morning, folks," he said, full of cheer, which was weird because this was not a cheerful occasion. But I guess doctors always have to try to lift the mood. "I'm Dr. Barnes." "David Butler," my father said, shaking his hand.
"Jessica," my mother said, doing the same.
"Randolph," Spoonie said, introducing himself with his government name. He got the nickname Spoonie because when he was young, he refused to eat with a fork. He was always scared he'd poke himself in the tongue, so he only ever used spoons. But that's not something you tell a doctor. "And Rashad," the doctor said, pointing at me. I nodded. "Nice to meet all of you. I just want to give you all an update on what's happening and what's ahead of us."
"Sounds good," Dad said.
"Okay, so Rashad's nose was broken, but we've already said it. So as long as he doesn't bump it or knock it, it'll heal just fine. The same goes for his ribs. There's really nothing we can do about them except make sure that Rashad isn't in any pain. But as long as they're fairly stable, they'll heal up as well. We did do an X-ray just to make sure there were no lacerations to any of his organs, and there weren't. So we're pretty much in the clear with that.
So when can he come home?
Ma asked, starting to beam.
Well, that's the thing.
Under normal circumstances, I would say that Rashad could go home tonight. Ma stopped rubbing my hand. The doctor continued. But this isn't a normal circumstance. He has some internal bleeding. Hemothorax, it's called. Which just means there are some torn blood vessels around his lungs due, I'm sure, to the impact. Usually this fixes itself, but we'll need to monitor him for a few days in case it doesn't.
And if it doesn't?
My mother began.
Then he'll need surgery, the doctor told us.
Surgery. That's one of those words that no matter how many times you hear it, it always freaks you out. Surgery. My mother's face tightened as she did everything she could to hold it together, but she couldn't keep her leg from bouncing like she always does when she's trying to keep her emotions tucked in. Spoonie bit down on his bottom lip. My father just seemed to be taking it all in, not particularly bothered.
Sound good? The doctor asked.
Sounds good,
Dad replied, shaking the doctor's hand once more. Dr. Barnes said he'd be in to check on me in a few hours and left. I reached for the remote and turned the channel. I wish there were more interesting things to tell you about the rest of the day, but the truth is that most of it I spent dozing in and out of sleep while my family sat around watching me doze in and out of sleep. Well, at least Ma and Dad did. Spoonie was in and out of the room, making and taking phone calls, and whenever he was in the room, he was texting. I didn't know who all the texts were going to, but I knew at least some of them were going to his girlfriend, Barry. And funny enough, Barry's little brother was my homeboy, English. English Jones, the athlete, pretty boy, non-asshole who everybody loved. Yep, that guy. So I knew that if Barry knew what happened to me, English knew. And if English knew, Carlos and Shannon knew. And if those two dudes knew, then by Monday, half the school would know. And then I was asleep. And then I was awake again. And Clarissa brought lunch in. I had barely touched breakfast. The oatmeal. Maybe a spoonful or two. It wasn't so bad, but after my father acted like my father, I had pretty much lost my appetite. I offered it to my mother, but she couldn't eat either. Spoonie ate the fruit cocktail and said it reminded him of elementary school. I used to love the grapes, but there was never enough of them, he said, holding the cup up to his face and slurping the fruit out. For lunch, Central Hospital served up its finest turkey club sandwich with vegetable soup. I ate half the sandwich after my mother pretty much forced me to eat something, and I have to say it was pretty good. All these years I had been hearing about how nasty hospital food was, and now that I finally got a chance to taste it, it wasn't half bad. Better than school lunch, that's for damn sure. Still nothing on TV except for an overly dramatic Lifetime movie that my mother was totally into. A cliche stalker story. A woman meets a man on a bus on her way home from work. They exchange numbers, go out on a first date. He's perfect, attractive, smart, and he has a good job as an audio engineer for television shows. She's excited until she finds out he's wired her whole house so that he can hear everything she does when he's not around. He can hear her shower and cook and talk to her friends about how crazy he is. And he listens to the feed while he watches TV, on mute, in the attic of the house next door, where he lives. She doesn't know this, though. Total stalker. Shittiest actors on earth meets the shittiest story on earth, which makes for the perfect Saturday afternoon movie for my mom. And then I was asleep. And then I was awake again. But this time, my folks were knocked out. Dad in the chair, his head bent at a painful-looking angle, his mouth wide open. As usual, my mother, small, had tucked her knees to her chest and nestled into her chair, the only cushioned one, like a child. She looked so peaceful, so calm. It was nice to see her get some rest. The only person who wasn't asleep was Spoonie. He was still sitting there, still fooling with his phone, still texting.
Spoon,
I called out softly. I didn't want to wake my parents. It was nice to have the room quiet for a moment. It was nice to not see their eyes. My father's disappointed, My mother's all sad and worried.
Spoonie looked up and rushed to my bed.
What's up, man? You okay?
I'm fine, I said, calming him down.
Okay, he said, glancing down at his phone.
Look, I talked to Barry and told her what happened. She's been all over the internet, checking to see if anything has been posted. You know, some live footage or something.
And?
And so far, nothing. But something's gotta pop up. And I don't care what Dad says, this ain't right. He bit down on his bottom lip.
It just ain't right. And you know me. You know I'm not gonna sit here and let them sweep this under the rug like this is okay.
I know. I gotta admit, there was a part of me that, even though I felt abused, wanted to tell him to let it go. To just let me heal. Let me leave the hospital. Let me go to court. Let me do whatever stupid community service they wanted me to do. And let me get back to normal. I mean, I had seen this happen so many times. Not personally, but on TV. In the news. People getting beaten. And sometimes killed by the cops. And then there's all this fuss about it. Only to build up to a big heartbreak when nothing happens. The cops get off. And everybody cries and waits for the next dead kid to do it all over again. That's the way the story goes. A different kind of Lifetime movie. I didn't want all that. Didn't need it. But I knew not to even bother saying it. Not to Spoonie. No point. Because he'd agree that this was normal. And that that was the problem. Spoonie had been dealing with this kind of crap for years. He'd never been beaten up. But he'd been stopped on the street several times, questioned by cops. Asked to turn his pockets out and lift his shirt up for no reason. He'd been followed around stores and stared at on buses by women who clutched their purses tight enough to poke holes in the leather. He was always a suspect. And I knew, without him saying a word, that the one thing he never wanted, but was sure would eventually happen, was for his little brother, the ROTC art kid, to become one too. So there was nothing that was going to stop him from fighting this. There was nothing I could do to calm him down. This was not going away. This was not getting swept under the rug of, oh well, not if Spoonie had anything to do with it.
Quinn. In our town, it really isn't shocking to see a fight go down. I've seen kids with house keys tucked between their knuckles throwing punches at each other. I've seen 10 guys from our school chasing 4 dudes from another school down a block and a stranger step into the melee with a bat to protect the guys who were outnumbered. In Gutso, Dwyer and I spent most of Jill's party telling ourselves we were tough as balls and that what happened outside Jerry's was nothing. It wasn't on our minds, we kept telling each other. No big deal. MBD, Dwyer wrote in beer on the wooden slats of the back porch with a nozzle from the keg. In fact, we spent most of the party on that back porch, ignoring everyone else. Gutso never said a word to Jill for me, and through the window, I saw English moving through the room like the friggin' king he is, getting up close to girls and making them laugh and giggle. I was sure if he found Jill, it'd be the same. I was out there in the darkness of the back porch, looking in through the window to the bright kitchen, like I was watching the whole damn party unfold on TV. I gave Gutso my flask at some point, and when I eventually got it back, it was empty, but I didn't bug him about it. Because even though what happened at Jerry's was MBD, it was really all we talked about that night. My brother has to deal with that shit every day, Gutso kept saying. And he just does it. No complaints. He's amazing. But what had always amazed me most about Gutso's brother Paul was how he had made time for me. I was 10 when my father died, and it was Paul who'd taken me down to Gooch to practice. Gooch was the neighborhood park, but Paul get us down there so early we'd have the whole court to ourselves. He showed me how to do the spider drill, how to dribble with 2 balls, how to tuck my elbows when I shot. But the man I'd watched grind a kid into the sidewalk, I don't know, was like someone else. Someone I couldn't place, some hulking animal stalking the shadows of my mind. All night, I could hear his voice, and yet it wasn't him. I could see his face, and yet it wasn't him. Dwyer and Gutso drank much more than I did, and they stood around the keg shouting out the lyrics of all the hip-hop songs blasting from the living room inside. Earlier that day, I'd imagined myself dancing with Jill, hands in the air and then down along her back to her hips as she draped hers around my neck. But I spent most of the night still stuck on that sidewalk outside Jerry's, my heart pumping fiercely in my throat, and when someone at Jill's yelled that the cops had arrived, I almost thought I'd call them there with my mind. I slept terribly, but no matter how much or how little I sleep, I begin almost every day the same way. Ma's voice in my head, telling me what I needed to do, what I needed to think about, how I needed to act. But on mornings like this one, or if Coach Carney was making us do suicides up and down the court for 15 minutes, or when Dwyer dropped another 5-pounder on either side of the bar on my last rep in the weight room, it was Dad's voice in my head, or at least what I thought was his voice. I hadn't heard it in so long, I couldn't even tell if it was his or if I was making it up. Whatever it was, it got me to where I needed to get. Push. If you don't, someone else will. Lift. If you don't, someone else will. Faster. 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 I was in the living room, my feet tucked under the lip of the couch, firing through a set of 50 crunches, when I heard Ma's actual sleepy voice drift up and over the room. "Don't kill yourself," she said. I've been so into my push-ups and sit-ups and all that, I hadn't even heard her come home. "Where's the mat?" she continued. I kept at it in my head. Push 25, 2, 3. Push 26, 2, 3. Push. Ma sighed. "Boys," she said. I heard her slough into the kitchen and open the fridge. I finished my set, sprang to my feet and felt the room spin. Black dots popped across my vision, and before I passed out, I dropped to the couch and sat there catching my breath. "Water?" Ma asked from the kitchen. "Yes," I whisper shouted, but she was already on her way to give it to me. Ma sat down next to me and put her head on my shoulder. She was so much smaller than me now, and I liked the way she sometimes leaned into me or hugged me, like she was excited, not in a weird way, but with something I think might have been pride. She'd already kicked off her shoes, and she'd already changed into one of the 3 t-shirts she always wore around the house. I drank my water in 2 long gulps. "Honey, you stink," Ma said, pulling away from me. "Sorry, gotta do my workouts, though, every morning." She rolled to the other side of the couch. "Get off! You're going to make the cushions stink." "Ma, I'm serious." She pushed my shoulder and laughed, and I rolled onto the floor. "Come on," she continued. "You'll ruin the rug." She leaned back on the arm of the couch and crossed one leg over the other. She could have fallen asleep right there. The bags under her eyes were prunes. Loose strands of hair sprang from her head like she'd pulled a wool hat off and the static electricity still hung in the air around her. But despite her exhaustion, somehow she still always found a smile for me. "What's the matter with you?" she said, yawning. "You look strange." "Nothing," I said. She rubbed her face and squinted at me, and I knew her mind was working to put it all together, but she was so tired. "I can trust you, right?" she asked, still slouched in the corner of the couch. "You tell me if something was the matter." "Of course," I said quickly, even though there was a hell of a lot on my mind. But I didn't feel like telling her about any of it. "I'm just going to rinse off," I said. It was going to be a 2-shower day. "Then I gotta hit the court. Coach is picking the starters this week." "You'll make it," she said, as if fighting for a starting spot was NBD. As if it had just come to me, because I wanted it, not because I had to fight for it. I left Ma slumped against the armrest and went straight to the bathroom. I got the water running hot first, then switched it to cold, just to fire up the senses and wake up. I still felt a little groggy from last night, and I was pissed at myself because after my workout, I wanted to get right to the court. I thought I had a real shot at being a starter. But next week was too important to coast through. I had to hit more 3-pointers when we went around the world. I had to have the higher free throw percentage. English was so good, he didn't have to give up the ball. So if he did, I had to make sure he felt more comfortable giving me the ball. And that meant working harder to get open and, more importantly, making the shot when I got the ball. Because the scouts were coming. Of course, the stands were going to be filled, but a few of those seats at every game were the seats we were all playing for. Full ride to Michigan State. Full ride to UNC. My dad had college paid for because he'd gone through ROTC at City College, but I had to do even better. Butler, Notre Dame, Villanova, Wisconsin, Arizona, Duke. St. Springfield's son needed to go full ride, too. Scouts paved the way, and I had to show them who I was. I had to be a starter. And as I was trying to psych myself up for a day of drills down at Gooch, I stepped out of the bathroom, wrapped only in a towel, holding my stank-ass clothes in a wad, and nearly ran right into Ma. She held my jeans in one hand and my flask in the other. She jutted her chin at me. Quinn Marshall Collins, you tell me the truth this minute, and you start from the very beginning. She pinched her lips tight. Is this how you want the world to know you? Some kind of derelict who doesn't give a damn about his actions? I stuttered. It was the strangest thing. I'd never been caught before. It was like there was regular me, the one Ma smiled at and loved, the one I'd always been, and then this new guy, the one shivering in the hallway outside the bathroom, standing in his towel, wondering why Ma had gone looking through my room while I was in the shower. Can I just get dressed? Ma sniffed. You have 30 seconds. Then she turned and marched to the kitchen. I broke the world's record for throwing on sweats and busting back to the kitchen. She sat on one side of the little formica table, steam from her mug of tea rising up to her face as she stared out the window to the Barrows house next door. The flask lay askew beside the mug. She ran her hand over her eyes and then up over her forehead like a visor. You know, she said slowly, this stuff can kill you. I know you don't think so, but it can. Ma, I said, sitting in the chair across from her. Listen, she interrupted. When you act like this, when you sit around breaking the law, thinking it is okay, you embarrass me. You embarrass your brother, and you embarrass yourself. You have more important things to worry about, young man. The flask sat on the table between us and she picked it up. She waved it gently. This is going in the garbage. Okay. Then I had to add, flat out lying, it was Guzzo's idea. But you took it from our house. I just checked. She'd never done that before. Plus, I only took a flask full after she'd emptied a glass or two from the bottle, and there was always a new bottle to replace the old one. And even if it was, she waved the flask again. Guzzo drank nearly the whole thing. Guzzo drank the alcohol. It was Guzzo's idea. You make it sound like you weren't there, Quinn, but you were. You were there. Maybe it was the alcohol still in my blood, but the way she said it, I was there, in the night. That hollowed out, gutted feeling making me nervous and stupider than usual, like I couldn't find the simplest words. I saw Paul. I'm sorry. Not good enough. I'm sorry I stole the bourbon. I'm sorry I drank it with Guzzo and Dwyer. You talk about wanting to be somebody. You talk about basketball. You talk about making your family proud, but then you act like this? What do you think people are going to think of you now? Jesus, Ma, I said. It's not that big a deal. It was only one night. It won't happen again. She tapped the flask with her finger. Remember you said that. That it was only this one time. Don't let it happen again. And don't Jesus, Ma, me. I looked out the window. I'm just saying that I know it was dumb and I'm sorry. I didn't even have that much to drink, I swear. It's not about that, Quinn. Ma leaned forward and grabbed my hands. She waited until I stopped looking out the window and looked at her. It's about how the world looks at you, and when they do, who do you want them to see? What kind of a person do you want to be? Who do you think you are? You're the one your brother looks up to. You're a senior, Quinn. This is the year everyone looks to see what kind of man you want to become. I pulled my lips tight against my teeth to try to keep calm and not tear up like a baby. I didn't want to be a baby. I didn't want to be a jerk off. I'm doing the best I can here, Ma continued. I'm on my own, honey, and I'm doing the best I can to help you, but I need your help to help your brother. She sipped her tea and watched me. I sat there like a mute because I didn't know what to say. I felt like an idiot. She sighed. I was going to ask you, but now I'm just telling you. Pick up Willie from his game today. The Cambies are bringing him. In fact, go see your brother's game. It means more to him if you're there than me anyway. So go see his game. She reached for her purse that hung on the back of her chair and pulled a few bills from her wallet. He looks up to you. Spend some time with him. Take him out for pizza after. Once basketball starts, we'll never see you. Take him out for lunch. So I did what I was told. And I put on some clean jeans and my light hoodie and took the bus over to the east side for Willie's game. Tough Will. Tough Will, who was known to sit down in the middle of his own soccer game, right there on the field, until his coach gave up and called in the sub. Tough Will spent most of his game sitting on the sidelines eating orange slices. When I got there, both teams were already warming up on either end of the field. I'd played soccer before I was in high school and loved it. For Tough Will, it was another story. It was only the warm-ups, and I could see him dragging his feet, not chasing anything or anyone anywhere. Just standing around and waiting for someone to pass him the ball. Get in there, man! I shouted. Will! Will! Get in there, man! He looked over at me and waved, totally oblivious to the rest of the players and balls around him. Still, I guess I inspired him because he turned and chased down a red and white ball and dribbled it a bit before taking a shot on net. It went wide left, but at least he ran after the ball. My phone started blowing up with texts, but Regina Cambie had set up a folding chair beside a cooler, and she was waving me over, so I had to ignore the text because I sure as hell couldn't ignore her. She sat with a few other moms, and the dads who'd come to the game stood around in a circle a little ways behind them, under the boughs of the one large oak tree that gave this park its name. I chatted with Mrs. Cambie at first, but then the game began, and I started cheering Willie and his team on, using that as an excuse to pull away as if I wanted to walk down the sidelines and see the action more clearly, because my phone kept buzzing and buzzing in my pocket, and I wanted to see what was going on. Guzzo had texted what's up 10 times. Saturday, 12:53 p.m. to Guzzo. How's your head? Saturday, 12:53 p.m. from Guzzo. Fucking awful. Saturday, 12:54 p.m. to Guzzo. Bananas and Gatorade, man. Saturday, 12:54 p.m. from Guzzo. I'm puking water if I drink it. Saturday, 12:55 p.m. to Guzzo. Damn, you busted? Saturday, 12:55 p.m. from Guzzo. No. Saturday, 12:55 p.m. to Guzzo. Fuck, I am, and I'm not even hungover. Saturday, 12:57 p.m. from Guzzo. It's a shit show here. Saturday, 12:57 p.m. to Guzzo. What? Saturday, 12:58 p.m. from Guzzo. Paul's home is a big deal. Saturday, 12:58 p.m. to Guzzo. Is it about yesterday? At Jerry's? Saturday, 12:59 p.m. from Guzzo. I don't know. Yeah. Saturday, 1 p.m. to Guzzo. Damn. Saturday, 1:02 p.m. from Guzzo. I guess we are having a barbecue tomorrow. Saturday, 1:02 p.m. to Guzzo. What? Saturday, 1:03 p.m. from Guzzo. Yep, see you then. Tell your mom to bring that marshmallow pie. Saturday, 1:03 p.m. to Guzzo. She has to work, I think. Saturday, 1:04 p.m. from Guzzo. Nope, I already know she's coming. I hesitated and he wrote again. Saturday, 1:06 p.m. from Guzzo. Everybody coming. Gotta bust. See you tomorrow. So something had to be up because the Galuzzo family never had people over. Or rather, they never invited people over. There were so many people coming and going from the house that it always seemed like a party, but they never officially organized anything. I tried him a few more times, but he didn't text back, so I gave up. I'd see him at the barbecue anyway, because of course I'd go. I always went, and wound up wolfing down Paul's famous burgers. But now I saw that face, Paul's, burning, a blood-red mask of rage. He'd been so focused on kicking the shit out of that guy. I'd seen him. Had he seen me? What if he had? I never felt nervous around Paul, and suddenly just thinking about him made me sweat. As I was going through all this, I tried to watch the game, but it was slow as all hell, and Will's team was terrible. Still, Will was playing left back, and he was actually running around and chasing the ball. Near the end of the first half, one of the players on the other team got around a couple of guys just over midfield and seemed like he had a clean break for a shot, but Will came out of nowhere and nailed a sweet slide tackle. The parents on the other side of the field started screaming like crazy, but Will's tackle had been legal, at least as I could see it, and that's what the referees thought too. And so when the first half ended, Will was the momentary hero, keeping the game more respectable because his team was only down 1-0. I found him and slapped him 5 over the heads of a few teammates in the huddle with his coach, and then I backed off. People always felt bad for me at games because of Dad, and Ma was always working, but I liked being on my own. I liked figuring out what I had to do and doing it. No one seemed to get that, and I didn't want to crowd Will either, so I let him be. His coach was thrilled and put him back in for the second half. Guzzo still didn't text back, and I went back and forth with Dwyer a few times, but eventually I put the phone away because it really was more fun to check out the game, and check out Will, especially. This might sound dumb to some people, but it's actually pretty cool having a little brother. I mean, he was a pain in the ass, and that I was here and not practicing over at Gooch pissed me off, but watching him smash into the guys on the other team, watching the way he shook off his own pain, made me realize that I did the same thing. Twirl my fist like I was revving myself up. He had the same crooked smile. And once, when there was a pause in the action and he was close to me on the sidelines and he was hunched over with his hands on his knees, he looked over at me and nodded, and I knew he was saying thank you. Not because I'd shown up to watch him, but because I had shown up to watch him, he was playing harder and he was loving it. And after the game, I didn't mind taking tough Will over to Mother's Pizza. On the bus back to the West Side, he kept asking me about the game and what his team could have done better. Scored a goal, I said. That would have helped. He rolled his eyes. Yeah, I know, but how? Your striker. He couldn't run. That was his problem. And when he had a shot, he hesitated. Can't hesitate. Like you, man. You were awesome today. I shook his shoulder and felt bad it was the only game I'd made it to all season. I wanted to be the guy who showed up, not the one who didn't. When we got to Mother's, it was slammed, like always. Mother sits on a corner, and the front door faces Spring Street, and the to-go window faces 20th Street. And while I usually just hit the to-go window, especially when I swung by at night, the line was jammed inside and outside. So I stuck Willie on the end of one of the two picnic tables and went inside to see if it moved any faster. It still took a while, and while I waited, I had to try to look everywhere else around the room except the one spot where I felt those eyes always watching me. That's why I preferred the to-go window. I couldn't see those eyes blazing into me, those eyes, my dad's eyes. In the photo the pizza guys had up on the wall, two guys in greasy t-shirts with their arms up around my dad's shoulders, dad a pillar of stone, dressed like usual in his Class A blues. The rest of the photos were of people in the pizza shop, but not the one with dad. He'd gotten the guys to make pizza for the soup kitchen at St. Mary's. His photo looked down on me. When I was finally up near the front, I felt a tug at my arm. I was about to turn back to Willie to tell him that he might have lost our seats, but it wasn't Willie at my arm. It was Jill. She pulled close to me so the people behind us couldn't hear. "Hey, Quinn, you mind getting an extra slice?" she asked. Her hair fell in two blonde-brown curtains around her face, and I could smell her shampoo as she looked up at me conspiratorially. And when a girl looks at you like that, all you can say is, "Whatever you want. I'll do anything for you. Is there anything else you want?" "Yeah," I somehow managed to say instead. "Yeah, you mind?" she grinned. "No, yeah, no," I laughed like a moron. The thing about slices at Mother's is that they are huge, so she stuck around to help carry it all outside. She offered some money, but I waved her off because I had it good at Mother's. I grabbed us all Cokes, too, because the guys and mothers always gave St. Springfield's son a major discount. And yeah, well, I was the kind of guy who just kept taking those free Cokes, no questions asked, like I actually deserved them or something. How are you planning on carrying this all out there on your own anyway? She asked. I had two giant slices and two Cokes by the necks of the bottles. She had two slices and a Coke. Guess I was just waiting for you, I said. She frowned, but in a cute way, like it was really a smile. Oh, yeah, I bet you were. Willie had managed to save two seats, but when he saw us, he got up and offered Jill his.
Please, he said.
She tried to protest, but he wouldn't let her. He stood at the end of the picnic table and glanced back and forth at us while he shoved pizza into his face.
One of us is what you'd call a gentleman, he informed us.
He's hilarious, Jill said to me. Now what kind of world did I live in where my 12-year-old brother was the cooler flirt than me?
Yeah, I said. I'm supposed to be his role model, but maybe it's the other way around.
Nah, she said. I bet he learned all this from someone. But this someone needs to sit down today, huh?
I'm old and broken. He's got his whole life ahead of him.
Yeah, Jill said. And you're hungover, right?
I knew it!
Willie yelped.
I knew you were going to a party last night.
Oops, Jill said. I pointed at Willie. Between us. Got me?
Oh, yeah,
Willie said.
Until I need the ammo.
Willie?
Will, please.
Jill laughed. She put her hand on Willie's wrist, and his face changed. His whole body probably blushed as deep red as his face. He gave her the dopiest smile. Had I looked like that when she'd asked me to get her a slice? Jesus. But Jill didn't mind.
Will, she said, don't get him in trouble, because then it will be my fault, and he'll never speak to me again.
I stared at Will, and he knew exactly what I was saying with my eyebrows. Don't fuck this up, dude.
Whatever,
Willie said.
I'm only kidding.
Willie and I shared the extra slice as Jill and I talked about the party. I tried to get a sense of whether or not she and English had hooked up, but I wasn't going to ask outright, because it really was none of my damn business. She was being super flirty, but not in the way I wanted her to mean it. This had happened before. Sometimes I got the feeling she thought of me more as a brother. But no dude wants to be thought of as a brother when he is sitting across from a girl who is not his sister and who makes his stomach flip when she says his name. While we were talking, though, things were getting a little heated over by the corner. A couple of guys had walked up to two other guys in line and started barking. They kept at it to the point where the rest of us outside couldn't even hear ourselves. People started yelling around them, and when one of the guys pushed one of the guys in line, they broke into punches. I jumped up and stuffed Willie into the seat behind me. People yanked out their phones calling the cops, but somebody must have called the cops already because the Berry lights flashed down the block. The guys in the fight tried to swing a few more punches, but people in the crowd had pulled them apart and locked them in arm holds. One cop car pulled up and then another, and everything happened so quickly we all just stood around watching like dumb idiots until the cops had grabbed the four guys who'd been fighting, pinned them to the hoods of the two cars, and cuffed them. I, of course, was back at the night before, where I'd seen Paul arrest the kid outside Jerry's. But this was different. Another cop car pulled up and then another, then all eight cops started asking the crowd to disperse, only holding a few people back to ask questions. This kind of thing happened all the time at Mother's. It sat right between neighborhoods, and kids from one block might beef with kids from another or some other shit, and while I tried to stay out of it, it was impossible not to watch it explode right in front of you. The crowd outside Mother's was white, black, Latino, Asian, just like Springfield. The four guys being cuffed were white. The cops, almost all of them were white, but two of them were black. It was impossible not to think about this as Paul slamming that black kid into the sidewalk the night before replayed in my mind. It wasn't like watching one of my brother's video games or a movie. You hear bone. You see real blood, and you taste the rust of it, and it makes you sick. I broke into a sweat like I might puke. I turned to Willie and Jill. Should we get out of here? More people began to shout at the cops from the crowd. I was done with this.
We'll walk you home, I told Jill. We busted back down the street away from the scene and took the long way around the neighborhood to Jill's house. I could tell Jill was as distracted as I was, as if we both had private conversations going on in the back of our minds, and we used Willie sandwiched between us as the focal point of conversation. But when we got to her house, she said over Willie's head, "There's a barbecue at my cousin's tomorrow. You must be going." Yeah, I said. Weird, right? A sudden party? She looked at me, and I realized we might not have been having private conversations in our minds the whole way home. They might have been the same one. Yeah, I said. I don't know, but I think I have an idea what this is about. Me too, she said. As she jogged up her front steps, something ugly and awful was forming in my mind, but I couldn't quite find the right words for it. Or I didn't want to. I wasn't sure. Sunday.
Rashad. Sunday. I slept late and woke up to an empty room. Silence. No one. So nice. Sunday TV is just as bad as Saturday TV, so I left it off and laid there in the cold space staring at the wall, thinking about everything. I was supposed to have been at Jill's party on Friday. Me, English, Shannon, and Carlos. Three-piece and fries. I was supposed to be all up on Tiffany Watts, giving her the business, because even though I was Soldier Boy when I was in school, everybody knew I was nice with the moves. Rhythm ain't never been an issue for me. I was the kid Spoonie made dance in front of his friends when we were younger. Showed him the latest steps that I picked up from music videos. I own the block party dance contests. So Jill's party, like every party, was my time to two-step without it being a march. My time to be at ease and let the soul seep back into this soldier. Damn shame I didn't make it. Instead, some big-ass cop decided to have a fist party on my face. You know, normal stuff. No biggie. I'm just a punk-ass kid. I have no rights. Just got body slammed for no reason. Just got my life threatened while lying flat on the sidewalk. A broken nose, broken ribs, and a knee in the back is way more exciting than fine-ass girls checking for me after they finish checking for English. Fuck. Knock, knock. The door opened and there was Clarissa pushing my lunch cart in. Good afternoon, Rashad, she said. She had one of those voices that no matter what was nice. Like, it could never sound mean. You know how some people have those voices? Like kindergarten teachers or librarians. How we feeling? She asked. And I was momentarily confused by the we she was referring to. I'm fine, I said, forcing a small smile. Good. Make sure you try to get yourself up today. You can't just lie there on your back. Also, I need you to blow into this as hard as you can. She held up a strange-looking plastic thing with a hole sticking out of it. What is it? It's called an incentive spirometer. Because of your ribs, you're going to do everything you can not to cough, but you need to cough. You got to make sure you're getting all the nasty stuff out of your lungs. Because if it all stays in, it might turn into pneumonia, and we don't want that. Then she broke it all down to me as if I was a child, which I appreciated because I had never heard of a spirometer before. Luckily, it was a simpler process than the name suggests. All I had to do, a few times every hour, was breathe in through the tube slowly, hold it, and then breathe out. As she set the spirometer on the side table by my bed, she announced, "For lunch today, we've got chicken tenders and fries and a small salad," while setting the tray down. Then she went through the routine of checking my vitals, blood pressure and whatever else. Whoever really knows what all those machines and stuff are anyway? I just know the one they put on my arm is for my blood pressure. But who, besides old people, even knows what blood pressure is? Just make sure I ain't dying, was what I was thinking as the cuff tightened around my arm. Once she left, I got myself up, which was way more painful than I thought it would be. Who the hell knew broken ribs could make everything hurt? Or maybe it was that everything I did made the broken ribs hurt. Seemed like even blinking was painful. I waddled slowly to the bathroom so I could handle my business,
the post-sleep pee, which was interrupted by another knock at the door. This time, it was my family.
Of course.
Rashad? My mother called through a crack in the door before pushing it open. I had just flushed and washed my hands while performing the strange task of looking at my bruised and broken face, but only in glimpses. That's all I could take. A few seconds at a time. 3 seconds, then back to the sink. Then back to the mirror for 3 more seconds before darting my eyes over to the paper towels. Anything longer than that made me uncomfortable. Anyway, I was making my way back to the bed when my mother and father came in dressed in their Sunday spiffs. Behind them, even more Sunday, as in Sunday himself. As in Jerome Johnson. As in Pastor Jerome Johnson.
Son, pastor's here to see you,
my father said as I eased back into bed, flashing my ashy butt at everybody, including God. They brought the pastor? I sort of fell quickly onto the mattress and whipped my legs around until they were on the bed. Pathetic. My mother helped me adjust, fluffing the pillow behind my head and pulling the sheet over me, up to my chin, which was way too far. She kissed my forehead and stared at me as if she was trying to recognize the kid beneath the bruises and bandages. You okay? I'm fine, I said, short. She nodded, then glanced at the food tray. She lifted the plate cover, the condensation dripping all over my chicken tenders.
Damn, soggy chicken tenders suck.
You haven't eaten.
It just got here. I just woke up, I said in a take-it-easy tone.
She kissed my forehead again, then leaned back so I could get a clear shot of my father, three-piece suited and shiny-shoed. And the minister, Pastor Johnson, dressed in an oversized suit, a gold chain with a gold cross lying perfectly in the middle of his fat satin tie. In his hand, the Bible. What else?
How you feeling, Rashad?
The pastor asked. Everybody was asking that, as if I was ever going to tell them the truth. Nobody wanted to hear the truth, even though everybody already knew what it was. I felt violated. That's the only way I can put it. Straight up violated. And now, to make it worse, I had to have church. Well, sort of church. I had to have prayer. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem with a good prayer. I mean, I believe in God. At least I think I do. I just wondered where God was when I was being mopped by that cop. And I knew that's what the pastor had come to tell me. That God was there. That God was always there. Which, to me, is the wrong thing to say, because if he or it or whatever was there and didn't do nothing, then that would make God my enemy, because he let it happen. I would much rather Pastor Johnson say that God wasn't there, that he was busy, that he turned his back just for a second to check on somebody else, than that asshole officer snuck right by him and got me. But nope. Son, I just stopped by to tell you that God is with you. He's always with you, the pastor started predictably. And everything happens for a reason. Reason? This felt like a good time for me to grab my spirometer because I was in need of a deep breath. I mean, seriously, what reason could there have been for this? Let me guess. I was too good looking and needed an extra bump on my nose? A reminder that only English Jones runs the school? Now we're gonna offer up a prayer for your healing, son, believing that God's gonna mend you, the pastor said. Let's all bow our heads and look to the Lord. My mother and father lowered their heads and closed their eyes. I didn't do either. Kept mine open and my head up, looking at the three of them, wondering if any of this mattered. I knew it mattered to them, my parents, and maybe that should have been enough for me to participate. But did it matter to me? I'm not so sure. The prayer was long and dramatic, full of the preachy punches in between each point. The pastor mentioned how Jesus was persecuted, ha! And Saul was made blind, ha! And Job was tested, ha! And David beat Goliath, ha! My mother followed right behind the pastor, accompanying his rhythmic prayer with hallelujah whispers. And my father's manly, but I guess godly grunts, all eventually, finally leading to an amen.
Amen. Spoonie stood in the doorway, nodding his head and clapping his hands, a sarcastic look on his face. Man, was I happy to see him. Ma was too. Dad, well, not so much.
Pastor, you remember my oldest son, Randolph, he said, caught off guard.
Yes, yes, of course I do.
The pastor reached out and shook Spoonie's hand.
Ain't seen you down at the church in a while.
That's 'cause I can't afford to come.
Spoonie, my mother gasped.
Sorry, he said, shrugging and smirking at me.
No, no, that's okay,
Pastor Johnson said kindly.
Nothing wrong with the boy having a mind of his own. God gave him that.
Spoonie just looked at Dad like, see?
Well, listen, I better be going. But we're going to keep you lifted up in prayer, Rashad, and we're going to add you to the blessing list for the sick and shut in.
But I'm not sick or shut in. I'm beat down. Is there a list for that? But I didn't say that. I was hoping Spoonie would do some kind of big brother ESP thing and say it for me.
Thank you so much for coming, Pastor, my mother said, clenching Pastor Johnson's hand.
My dad gave him a firm handshake and a tight-lipped nod, and the churchmen headed out. 5 seconds couldn't have gone by before Spoonie sat gingerly on the side of the bed and grabbed the remote.
Come on, man, it's Sunday. Ain't nothing on but reruns of what we just experienced, I joked.
Oh, there's something else on, trust me, Spoonie said pointedly. You know, you don't always have to be so damn disrespectful.
Dad started in on Spoonie with a bark, settling into a chair on the other side of the room.
Cursing, right after the pastor left. Tisk, tisk, tisk.
Spoonie ignored him and turned the TV on. He nodded up to the screen.
Check it out.
I looked up at the glowing screen, and there it was. There I was, on the freaking news.
Again, this is footage that was taken from a smartphone Friday night of a police officer shoving a young man through the door of Jerry's Corner Mart on 4th Street. As you can see, the officer already has the young man subdued. He doesn't seem to be resisting, but is still slammed to the ground, where the officer proceeds with what looks to be unnecessary force. Jerry's has experienced a string of robberies, but as of now, we are uncertain as to whether or not this was another one of those cases. We attempted to contact Jerry's management for a comment, but to no avail. The Springfield PD has also declined making a statement at this time. What we do know is that the young man in this video is 16-year-old Rashad Butler of West Springfield. We'll keep you updated as we learn more.
My mother's mouth gaped.
What? I mean, how? Spoonie, how'd they get my name?
I stared at the TV in disbelief.
I told you, Lord Brother, there are always witnesses. Berry kept checking online all night, YouTube, Facebook, everything, and eventually the video surfaced. So we sent it to the news, told them who you were.
At this, my dad lost it.
I mean, seriously, have you lost your damn mind? Are them things on your head affecting your thinking? Rashad doesn't need this kind of attention, Spoonie. He doesn't need all this craziness. None of us do.
Spoonie jumped to his feet.
You think me sending it to the news is crazy? The crazy part is what happened to Rashad. What's happening all over this country. You of all people should know that.
My father glared at Spoonie, and I mean he held it there, as if there was, in fact, some kind of father-son ESP thing, and he was beaming the cuss out of the century straight to my brother's brain. Then, like he always did, Dad stormed out of the room, followed by Spoonie throwing words at his back.
Yeah, run away as usual.
Spoonie!
Ma shouted. My throat dried. My stomach boiled. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, it was me, but it wasn't. But it was. I didn't know how or what to feel. Like, how could I be that boy? A victim. Me. It was just, I don't know, surreal. But we kept watching as the story looped. Sunday, aside from being a whack TV show day, is also apparently a slow news day. Every few minutes, the footage of me being crushed under the weight of the cop played. The news person talking about the string of robberies,
and not being able to get a comment from Jerry's management or the police department. Then a picture of me dressed in my ROTC uniform flashed across the screen. I glared at Spoony.
"Where'd they get that?"
I asked, already knowing the answer. "Man, listen, I had to make sure we controlled as much of the narrative as possible."